the air conditioner's out. So I'm going to do this podcast episode practically naked. I do have my sandals on, but that's just because I don't like to touch the floor. But so it's a good thing it's not video. Welcome back, everyone, to episode 18, according to Cameron. This is the Life of Caesar podcast. This is Ray taking over just for this one time to see how it goes. And Cameron's just sitting there quietly, which must be driving him crazy. Cameron, how are you doing?
Ave, Ray. I am, yes, biting my tongue. Very hard for me to let you control the opening of the show.
Now I have a little bit of the experience of what it's like for your wife. So we just want to say hello to with the Quirites, the patrons, the VIPs, the consuls, the patricians, the plebeians. Is there anyone else I have left out?
No.
Okay.
I think you've done a good job. And all the people that have written iTunes reviews, we're going to call you out by name,
yes,
along with the patrons later on in the show. But thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And especially to all the ladies out there who, you know, wear nothing under their toga. Thank you.
I have no idea where that came from. I apologize, ladies and gentlemen, for that last comment of race.
Me too. I'm sorry. Okay. So
if we're flipping roles in this show, then you're offending everyone and I'm apologizing for you.
I'm being
the nice guy. Yeah.
There we go. Wow, that must be uncomfortable for you. Okay, so where did we, if we're going to just jump right into this and to do the reviews and other stuff later, but we'll just get to the Caesar and offending people right now. Where did we leave off last time?
Last show, Ray, Caesar had to deal with the Germans, and he decided he was going to take the battle to the Germanic tribes, so he built the mother of all bridges, crossed the Rhine. They ran away. The Sagambri ran away into the forests. So he basically just torched their farms, their villages, laid desolation to everything that they left behind, and put up a big sign saying, right, that's what happens.
Caesar was here.
Yeah. I burnt your shit down. Yeah. I huffed, I puffed, I blowed your house down, and went back to Gaul. He's now feeling pretty confident that the Germans are going to keep crossing the Rhine willy-nilly. Right. The Gauls have been pacified. He has a peace. Well, you know, he's basically destroyed the Veneti. He's destroyed everyone that's pissed him off. Now, finally, he can get back to what he wanted to do 6 months ago, which is check out this mythical land of tin that the Venetians were supposedly trading with to see if it exists and if it has all of the pearls that it's supposed to have, giant beasts, people with posh accents, Ricky Gervais. What else? Yeah, right. He was just... Yep. And a lot of, as we said last time, a lot of people in Rome were like, dude, this place doesn't even exist.
That's
you're going to reach the end of the earth. You're going to fall off. It was considered mythical, like we think of Atlantis today. Like, imagine if somebody in 2014 said, I'm going to go and invade Atlantis.
Right.
You would, is essentially... And Caesar was like, well... No. I mean, I haven't been able to find out a lot, but about this place because no one's talking.
Right.
But I have reason to believe it there's probably something there, and no Roman,
that's right,
has ever been there before. And my motto is to go where no Roman has gone before. So I'm going to go check it out for the glory of Rome, of course. Right?
Absolutely. I thought it was interesting when he recrossed the Rhine back into Gaul. He pretty much kept his troops together, and you know, he was pretty much, even though it's what, mid-August or something like that, he's decided he's going to check out Britain, even though it's so late in the campaigning season. And I love the way my book, I don't know about your book, but my book said, and he kept all his troops together, and together they all pretty much, you know, walked slash rode their horses all the way to the coast. And if you ever look at a map, for those of you who do not live in Europe, to go from the Rhine to all the way to the coast near Bourbon or wherever, or Boulogne, I'm not sure where that's at exactly. Where is it? Boulogne. I mean, that's a heck of a trek to make with your men, and most of the men had to walk. I was just impressed with that. And this is even before the fighting starts. I mean, this man is just covering incredible amounts of territory, 2,000 years ago. I just think it's amazing.
Yeah. It's a long trip, but, a long journey starts with the first step. That was Caesar's motto. The area where the fleet, the fleet that he'd built to fight the Veneti was off the coast of a territory known as the Marini. Modern, it's Pas-de-Calais. Pas-de-Calais. And the Marini actually hadn't done it, concluded a treaty with Caesar before this point. They were still hostile towards the Romans, but they heard Caesar was arriving and they decided that making a peace treaty was probably a good idea. Word had got to them that this was probably the smart move to make.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, who's coming? And he's bringing how many? Oh, all of them. No, peace. Yeah, here's some hostages. Where do I sign? No problem. Because they want to give him some attitude. And I just thought it was amazing that at the point where he has all his ships, he's got the ships that he had built for the Veneti, the captured ships of the Veneti, plus a couple of others that he was able to borrow from other allies. So this guy's got a whole bunch of ships waiting to load up his troops, but as many ships as he has, it's not nearly enough to take all his men. So he's going to be taking only two legions with him when he goes, which is not exactly enough men to conquer an island, if it exists.
Yeah, I read in one part of the, apart from the warships that he had about 100 transport ships. I read somewhere else that he had about 80 transport ships. I think he had 100 in total, but the 7th and the 10th legions went on to about 80 of them.
Right.
So assuming there were about 4,000 men per legion, that's about 100 per transport.
Wow.
They would have been stacked in like...
Sardines?
Yes.
Which the Roman...
I was going to go somewhere else with that, but let's go with science.
Yeah.
That's right. So, and then the other 18 transports were allocated to the cavalry.
Yeah.
And his senior officers and their staff and whatever else they took with them were on the war galleys, fairly cramped, we imagine.
Right.
So this is a pretty small force to set out and invade a country, two legions. He really has no idea what he's facing when he gets there.
Right. And I just think it's interesting. So he has very little information. He's kind of hoping the island exists. He has no reconnaissance. He's taken a small force. And because he's only got so many ships that he's packing with men, he can't really take a lot of food with him. But his idea is, at this time of the year, I can just harvest the corn, the wheat or whatever it is. And I'll just get my men to do that. Food is not going to be a problem. Everything's going to work out just fine.
Yeah. But it didn't work out fine.
No, it did not. This is the one time I was a little disappointed in Caesar. Really? You came up? I think his enthusiasm got the better of him because he shouldn't have gone. It was the wrong time of the year. Didn't take enough troops. Sure as hell didn't take enough food. Didn't take enough equipment. So this has got potential. He doesn't know anything about the land. Doesn't really know anything about the land. This has just got disaster potentially written all over it.
Yeah, it's very unlike Caesar, isn't it?
We
tend to think of Caesar as being meticulous, planning everything, thinking it through, having a backup strategy for his backup strategy. But here he seems to have been a little bit impetuous. And I wonder if part of this is that he did try and research. He's got no idea what he's going into. So, screw it, let's just go and check it out. Secondly, they're not a seafaring nation, the Romans. So didn't really know how to read the weather signs, maybe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not know crap about tides and everything else.
reminds me a little bit of some of Napoleon's early seafaring adventures in Egypt up against bugger lugs.
Which are on Nelson. Which island? Nelson.
No, I was thinking Wellington. He wasn't on a boat. No. Nelson. Because, you know, the French obviously were pretty inferior from a naval capacity to the Brits at that stage. Or Napoleon going into Russia in 1812, not really knowing what he's getting himself into in many ways. This isn't quite that scale of disaster, but for Caesar, it is a bit of a cluster frack.
Yeah. Exactly.
Trying to retain our NSFW rating this week. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting that so he's going to leave obviously the most of his troops behind. Some of the Menapi and some of the other Marini tribes have not been subdued or have given him hostages. So he's going to send some troops to go after them, but obviously a large part of his force is going to stay there at Boulogne to protect his embarkation point, because if that's not secure, the whole thing can fall apart really quickly. So even though Caesar doesn't know a lot about it, we should probably explain that the man did try. He talks to some traders who trade with Britons. The vast majority of them, if not all of them, are Gauls. There's very few Romans trading this far up in Gaul, and they don't really either know much or they purposefully don't tell him anything, because they know Caesar's about to come and put his personal stamp on everything, and it's going to screw up their trade, their livelihood, everything. So they don't tell him very much. So he's got very little to go on. So he's going to send someone of his own that he can trust. They might not know the area, but he can trust whatever information they bring back. The problem is he doesn't bring very much back at all.
Yeah, he sends one of his officers, Volusenus. Mm-hmm. Volusenus, he goes, go and check out this land of tin.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, at least Volusenus came back and said, well, I saw a coastline, so there's something there. That's so right. Caesar didn't set off with 8,000 troops without knowing that there was at least somewhere to land.
There was a coastline.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, people back in Rome may still have thought it was mythical, but Caesar knew there was something there. But Volusenus didn't really come back with much more information because he didn't risk landing on the coastline, not knowing what he was getting himself into. Obviously, you know, probably didn't have very many troops or anything with him.
Right.
If he'd landed and they'd been attacked by giants and dragons. He would have nothing to come back and report. So he comes back and says, Gaius, there's something. And Caesar's like, seriously, that's all you've got. There's something. That's it? Yeah.
Man, with my intellect, you're telling me there's definitely something there. Proconsul. Thanks.
That's great. Yeah. Now, you've been a big help, Valensis.
That's right. I'm thinking about cutting your head off. So that doesn't work out too well. But again, he's got to hurry up. He can't play around. But before he takes off, this sounds like good news, but it turns out not to be. Before he takes off, some of the Britons, the tribes, hear about what he's going to do because, you know, they have merchants go back and forth and they hear things. So several tribes representatives or envoys, whatever you want to call them, actually come to him in Gaul. And they're like, okay, we heard what you're going to do. Let's establish a relationship.
Yeah, so Caesar sent back his own envoys back to Britain to say, look, we're coming.
Now,
be nice.
But that confused me. So he picks a Gallic chieftain named Comnenus, and he makes him the king of the Atrebates because Caesar can just promote anybody he wants. He sends him over as an envoy, but obviously this man either has really bad breath or bad manners, but I don't know what, or maybe he has a past dealing with him, but basically he's just short of being abducted or apprehended by these people. The Britons aren't very happy with either him or this move, and he is not allowed to return to tell Caesar anything. So another attempt at either relations and or reconnaissance fails miserably for Caesar, who's about to ship.
Yeah, you know, you think of it from the perspective of the tribes that were in Britain. They've tried to send peace envoys. They've come back saying, "Nah, he says he's coming over anyway." So, you know, it's all out war now.
Right.
They're going to take captives. They're going to attack.
Yeah.
I wonder what was going through their heads. Like, yeah. I'm assuming that, I mean, they'd had some dealings with the Venetians.
Right.
So they knew the Gauls, but they've never seen a Roman before. They don't know anything about them, or they must have heard rumors about how,
yeah,
what they've been doing to the Gallic tribes. Imagine that you've been hearing these stories and now they're coming to your land. Wow. Right.
I can only imagine the initial thought is, oh, crikey, or whatever, you know.
Crikey?
Crikey. Oh, crikey.
They weren't Australian tribes, dude. They were British.
Is that an Australian word?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I take that back.
Well, maybe they'd say it as well. Yeah, I did, but they would have spoken like this. I don't believe they spoke like Prince Charles back in the day.
Well, why wouldn't they?
Who
knows? Yeah.
So, okay, so
Caesar's coming, bitch. Sorry.
Caesar sets off in the boats and it doesn't go well initially. Oh,
And this is one of your favorite things. Let me give some perspective. Something I was able to find out, and you never really know if this is 100% true or whatever, but I read somewhere that he left August 25th around midnight. Don't ask me why. Maybe it has something to do with tides. I don't know when. And he got there about 9 a.m. the next day. But when he gets there, he's somewhere, and I don't want to steal your thunder, Cameron. I'll just say this and I'll stop. He gets somewhere near Dover. Not only are there huge darn cliffs there, but when he looks up, he sees a whole bunch of Britons with swords and shields and chariots and horses staring down at him. So this is not a good first move. So he has to weigh anchor and decide what he's going to do next.
Yeah, White Cliffs of Dover, which I saw, by the way. I went to a documentary a couple of weeks ago with my friend Ian. Kath took me along to see a Nick Cave documentary. Do you know Nick Cave?
No, sorry.
Australian sort of rock star, been around since the late 70s, lives in England these days.
Trader.
And his violinist, Warren Ellis, lives in this little cottage that overlooks the White Cliffs of Dover. And this is part of this documentary where they go to this little, very, very humble cottage on a beautiful cliff top, and in the background through his kitchen windows you just see these white cliffs of Dover. It's really really breathtaking and amazing. So obviously Caesar couldn't land there, so they start moving along the coastline looking for a better place to land, and up on the top of the cliffs they can see the Poms following them. They can see these crazy tribes with blue faces. What was that Mel Gibson movie?
Not Braveheart.
Braveheart.
Yeah. Braveheart. What will you do with freedom? Yeah, that. That's the only thing I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the ships move out about 7 miles north, and only the men with horses and chariots can keep up with him. So as they're following him, the numbers are start to decrease, but still Caesar's going to have trouble. He knows it, even trying to land troops on this island.
And the ships can't get in close. They can't land on the beach. So guys have got to jump into the water and, move to – I've got to stop saying you know. I was listening to the recent show. And I've picked this up from my Valley Girl American wife saying you know after everything. I never used to say that. I don't know when this started, but it annoys the hell out of me when I listen back to our
shows.
Just
don't talk to her anymore. You can stay married. Just don't talk to her anymore. Don't tell her I said
that. Yeah. Yeah, okay. You're going to be very popular when you come over here in April, then.
They're heading north.
They head north, but they can't land is the problem. Even when they find a good location, they can't pull the boat in. They didn't have a jetty. Yeah. They didn't have a – what else do you land a boat on?
A ball, a pier, a dock.
They didn't have any of that. And they couldn't pull it right in, so they had to jump off. Now, the British tribes have got arrows, they've got slings, they're attacking them with all sorts of stuff from the shore. Now imagine you're on a ship which isn't moving,
right?
And so you're a sitting target for a lot of this stuff. Secondly, you need to, if you're going to jump off and try and move through fairly deep water or even right. get in some sort of a landing boat, you, again, you're not moving very fast. You're a sitting target for these British barbarian tribes attacking you.
Right.
And Caesar says in his commentaries that when they tried to land, his troops, who were normally fairly confident and aggressive,
yeah.
did not have their normal enthusiasm.
Right.
I was going to read from the commentaries, or am I getting too far ahead of you?
No, you go ahead.
So Caesar writes, when Caesar observed this, he means his troops not really rushing into battle, he ordered the ships of war, the appearance of which was somewhat strange to the barbarians, and the motion more ready for service, to be withdrawn a little from the transport vessels and to be propelled by their oars and be stationed towards the open flank of the enemy, and the enemy to be beaten off and driven away with slings, arrows, and engines. By engines, he means siege.
Bolt shooting, yeah.
Yeah, shooting the bolts or propelling stuff at
them. Yeah, there you go.
Like a trebuchet or, you know, yeah.
Yeah. So I thought it was... I'm sorry, are you still reading?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Which plan was of great service to our men, for the barbarians, being startled by the form of our ships and the motions of our oars and the nature of our engines, which was strange to them... Oh, my goodness. Stopped and shortly after retreated a little. And while our men were hesitating whether they should... It just reminds me. My wife's got this thing, she always says, when we're watching a British film. Is that guy gay or just British? Hello. Now, she says that, not me. I get enough hate from Americans. Now I'm going to get hate from the Poms as well. Mm. We used to get that on the Napoleon show all the time. Oh, I get called anti-American now. Back then, I'd get called anti-British. I've been called anti-everything. While our men were hesitating whether they should advance to the shore, chiefly on account of the depth of the sea, he who carried the eagle of the 10th Legion, after supplicating the gods that the matter might turn out favorably to the legion, exclaimed, "Leap, fellow soldiers, unless you wish to betray your eagle to the enemy. I, for my part, will perform my duty to the Commonwealth and my general." When he had said this with a loud voice, he leapt from the ship and proceeded to bear the eagle toward the enemy. Then our men, exhorting one another that so great a disgrace should not be incurred, all leapt from the ship. When those in the nearest vessels saw them, they speedily followed and approached the enemy. So what's fascinating about that to me, Ray, is it's not Caesar who's motivating the troops to get off the boats, in his own words. It's one of his eagle bearers of the 10th Legion who doesn't even get named in this.
He got dissed.
And we don't know what happened to him. He might have been killed in the battle. He might have jumped off and immediately got killed. He doesn't tell us anything about it, which I find fascinating because, you know, like Caesar usually likes to take some of the credit for motivating the troops to, you know, jump over the line. This time it goes to some sort of unnamed legion.
Some guy. Yeah. Well, I the book I read was that his social status wasn't high enough to warrant mentioning his actual name. But as far as bravery goes, I mean, he freaking saved the day. You think Caesar, who is pretty much about ability and courage, would have said, "The heck with the rules or what's normally done. I'm gonna give this guy a shout out," but he does not. So just to give everybody some perspective, Caesar's troops are going on shore. It's hazardous. They're getting hit with arrows and slings. They're going in groups of one and two. It's all ugly. It's all unorganized. And that is simply not how Romans do things. They're being attacked by the men jumping off the chariots and the horses. And it's looking pretty bad. So Caesar has some of the other ships purposefully come up close and ram the ground, so their archers, their slingers, and the artillery, the bolt shooting artillery, can be closer. So finally, his men have a modicum of cover. So the British have to back up a little bit. And during all this, And this is something Cam and I would have done in our younger years. If we would have been the Eagle Bear, which you cannot even put into words how important it was for the individual legion. You know, it's like their entire honor, their soul, everything about that legion was wrapped up in this.
It's not just a flag, right?
It's not exactly. It's right. It's like an emblem. It's like a gold or whatever metal. But he literally.
I mean, sorry to interrupt. But I mean, like, it wasn't just we're carrying a flag. Like, as you say, that the troops.
Huge.
Yeah, I mean, the greatest disgrace a troop could face was to lose their standard, lose their flag. I mean, it was huge. I mean, hugely disgraceful. This was, I don't know, what's a modern, I can't think of a modern analogy, really.
Yeah, I mean, because it's a huge loss of face for the entire group, not only for the men to each other, but also to their general and to Rome. I mean, I don't think there are words. I don't think there is anything in today's terms that could compare to it. So according to Caesar, this guy says his prayers, makes his speech, jumps off the freaking boat and runs right at the enemy. He doesn't just run ashore. He's running right at the enemy as fast as he can. So all the men around him have to run and protect him. And the other men and other ships see them jumping off. So they jump off. So finally, there's a modicum of organization on the beach. But it's still so crazy. The men aren't following their legion or their Eagle Bear or their officer, whichever officer they come up on first, they just start to form up. It's still total chaos, but at least more troops are on the beach. They're getting some order and they're able to eventually push the Britons back who are impressed by this.
I tell you who this Eagle Bear reminds me of, you know, the HBO series Rome. Mm-hmm. Actor Ray Stevenson, he plays Titus.
Yes, love
just,
him.
Yeah, me too. I love that actor. But that just that idea of, you can imagine that guy standing on the boat and going, well, going to die sometime. Let's go. You know, he just had that kind of, well, does it?
Come
you know,
on, you bastards. And just run. Yeah. So finally, Caesar gets ashore. He brings all the troops together. But his problems have only just started. Because even though his two legions are with him and they're starting to disembark, his cavalry, the 18 ships of several hundred horse and their men, they got caught in and I don't know jack about naval stuff or anything like that, but they got caught in an ill wind or whatever, and so they're not there. He can't run out and have them chase down these guys and kill them because all he's got is infantry. They're not going to catch charioteers. They're not going to catch horsemen. So he's just, the best he can do is bring everything up. He takes his the ships that are sails, they're anchored. The other ships are dragged on land, and they're able to build a typical Roman camp just off the shore. So at least he's got that established. The men are safe. He's on the island after all that craziness, but he has no cavalry.
So his cavalry is stuck trying to get there from Gaul. They've had bad weather. They've tried again a second time. 12 ships are destroyed and the rest are damaged extensively.
Yeah. It's ugly. Yeah.
Yeah. So Caesar's doesn't have a cavalry. His own ships are destroyed. He's kind of cut off from the continent. He doesn't have any food, doesn't have cavalry, and is on the shores of a strange land. So he's in a very weakened position. The British tribes obviously can tell that, realize that he's looking pretty vulnerable and weak, and decide to attack him again.
Yeah. If I could mention something right before that, something that happens. So when he gets his men on land and they build their camp, and just the sheer number of ships that they see, the Britons are impressed. They do back up. And when he builds his camp, they see this and they're like, okay, well, you know, we tried to stop him, but we didn't. So there's actually some communication between some of them and Caesar. They give over hostages and they even return to Caesar Commius, the guy that they had, the envoy that he had sent over.
Commius.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure how to say his name. Commius. And he's got a couple of horsemen with him. Not too much, but at least Caesar has a very small cavalry now. He's got something. So days go by. It's still bad weather. The cavalry ships are still trying to come in, but they're getting damaged by the storm. And then the Britons are going, he's got very little food. His ships are damaged. He's got no cavalry. They're running out of food quick. He didn't bring a lot of men. And then the chieftains who had been talking to him kind of slip out of the camp, and they go, "Oh, I'm just gonna go home. I forgot something at home, and I left the lights on.
Yeah.
I left the light on." So they all slip out, and then what do? They cut off what little grain they were giving him. They cut it off, and they're thinking either we can wipe him out, or if his ships can't land because the weather's just getting worse, we have all winter to annihilate him, and maybe the Romans will never come back. So we can either get him in the short term or we'll get him in the long term, but we're not going to feed him. He's going to get weaker, and this is going to be the end of Gaius Julius Caesar and his two legions. And so they're ready to do something. They're ready to attack. So when some of his men are out there getting grain, they're harvesting the corn or harvesting grain, they lay an ambush for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they got a plan. They think they're being clever, and they probably would have gotten away with it. But we didn't really talk about this. And what it is you have Caesar's main camp, but surrounding his camp are little outposts, and their job is to keep the main camp safe. And some of the men in the outlying outpost see a whole bunch of dust in the air where the guys were harvesting the corn, and they get word back to Caesar, and Caesar's like, "That's just way too much freaking dust for just some guys getting some corn. They're under attack." So he's got to go out and save his men. But it's not like he's got thousands of cavalry. He takes the men from the outpost, and they run out there as fast as they can. They get out there, and they're able to save their men, but they don't bring back any grain. So he's still screwed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some interesting stuff, I think, in Goldsworthy's book about the use of chariots at this stage in Britain. He confirms that chariots had fallen out of use by the Gauls and by the Romans before this time. They weren't really, you know, you think about a chariot in a battle, not a very easily manipulated piece of equipment. You can't turn suddenly, I imagine. Very difficult to stand on a chariot if it's moving and fire an arrow or hurl a javelin or anything like that with any
I'm sorry, I was just gonna say, and the horses are gonna be shy. It's not like you can just, you know, they don't want to fight. If there's noise or whatever, you know, horses are gonna get spooked.
Spooked.
Hey, you thought that.
British or gay? Caesar in the commentaries gives a detailed description of the chariot tactics, knowing that this would be really popular back home. And he says basically what happens is they drive all over the field with their chariots and they throw their javelins, but it makes a lot of noise too. Kind of terrifying to the enemy, supposedly. And then once they've scared them, they jump down out of the chariots and fight on foot and charge them. And the chariots sort of withdraw away from the main battle and just sort of watch what's going on. They can, you know, ride back in if they need to pick up the troops to escape or to pull back or something like that. He's kind of fascinated by that. And chariots also allowed aristocratic warriors to look impressive because they were expensive pieces of machinery.
Oh yeah,
and they were often, you know, decked out, made to look quite flashy. I'm sure they had pearls. pearl necklaces on, so they would, they made you look good if you were a chieftain or a king or whatever it was. You know, you got to ride in the thing.
And Caesar was saying that they can jump off, and you have the stability of infantry. They can get back on, and they have the advantages of cavalry. So it wasn't bad. I mean, he certainly didn't come home and implement it in his legions, but he respected what they were able to do, and you know, it worked for them. They were able to kill some of the Roman soldiers getting grain, but when Caesar shows up with the men from the outpost, he's able to bring him back. But it was just so frustrating that whenever he thought he could get close to one, the chariot would come up, he jumps on and he gets away. So they couldn't inflict the casualties that they had been inflicting in Gaul. It was very frustrating. So they come back to the camp, And they bring all their men back, but yes, they have lost some men. Now the Britons are like, oh, we had him. We almost had Caesar. He's still weak. So let's get everybody together and we're going to form up and we're going to fight in the more traditional sense. So they got a lot of forces together and they come near his camp. And Caesar's like, okay, this I get. This I understand. So he brings his troops out and they all line up. And now it's time for a battle that Caesar understands and he can plan for it to a certain degree. And again, he has trouble with the charioteers, but he's able to fight, kick some ass, and he wins the day. And the Britons are like, okay, oh, we were wrong. So why don't we start parlaying again? We're really sorry. That was a big, huge misunderstanding. Because when they fight the way Caesar gets, he's going to win almost every time.
Now, I just wanted to say a few more things about chariots
before we move off
of chariots. Sorry. No, that's don't apologize, right? It's okay. It's all right. It's all right. Yeah. It's all right. It's okay, right? Shh. It's okay. The Romans never really used chariots for warfare, which is why Caesar's kind of fascinated by this. People may think of chariots at Rome and et cetera, if they've seen some old Hollywood films. But they were really used just for racing and for circuses.
Yes.
And they could be drawn not only by horses, but sometimes by dogs or tigers or even ostriches.
Get the fuck out of here. Ostriches, that would be so awesome. Sorry, I lost it.
No, I'm with you on that, man. I want to see... I want to see. We should bring that back when we do our TV show.
Hell to the yeah!
Version of this, we need to get ostriches pulling us on a chariot. That would
be gotta happen. Yes.
That would be awesome.
And then we'll go to jail, but it will be awesome.
Yeah, I really, we'd go to jail.
The cruelty to ostriches—it's gotta be illegal. I don't know.
It's cruel to make them pull a chariot. It's not cruel to have horses pull a chariot, but ostriches.
They don't have, their union is not as strong. I don't know.
You're probably right. I don't know why, though, the Romans never used them in warfare. Do you have any perspective on that?
The only thing I was able to get is because, you know, the from the time of Gaius Marius and maybe a little bit before him until Caesar's, there's been some modifications as far as the way the Romans fight, the length of the sword, which we've talked about, I don't know how many episodes ago. But basically for the Romans, what they had worked. And so, I mean, there would have been tweaking here and there, but they're not going to totally revamp what they do because what they've done so far just has worked so well.
Right. But they probably got the idea of chariots either from the Etruscans who came before them or from the Greeks when they conquered Greece sort of, you know, circa 146 BCE. And I think the Greeks used chariots in battle. So, but maybe what you're saying is right. Maybe even by, I mean, they obviously conquered the Greeks with their chariots. So they thought...
Yeah, well, so, not so much about that.
We'll have used them for circuses.
That's right.
Then not very useful from a warfare perspective. All right. Yeah. I just wanted to talk a bit about that because I wasn't really too aware before my research about the Roman perspective of chariots versus the British tribes.
Right. I don't know what the Latin is for if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But that's probably a bumper sticker that Caesar had on the back of his horse's ass. And so he didn't use chariots, something like that. So they're able to kick the crap out of the Britons, push them away. And again, he doesn't have a large cavalry. So the best he can do is burn the farms and villages around. But then he's got to get back to his fort. And then that's when the Britons come back and go, oh, we're sorry. Let's talk again. And you can just jump in anytime, Cam, but Caesar is really pissed. He's really frustrated. And he's like, okay, you want to be friends? We'll be friends. But this time I want double the number of hostages. And I'm so pissed and I'm so out of here that you are going to have to ship them over to Gaul yourself because I'm getting the fuck out of here. So peace is concluded. Give me hostages. I'm out of 5,000.
Well, he also had to get back because he heard, despite his conviction before he left Gaul, that everything was hunky-dory at Gaul, that the tribes had started to cause trouble again.
Yeah.
And not only had he gone to Britain and found no pearls and no tin and no jewelry and nothing really, of any value and lost a lot of his ships and his cavalry and blah, blah, blah. But he might also lose Gaul as well if he doesn't get his ass back there quick smart. So, yeah, he concludes a peace treaty pretty promptly with the British tribes. Heads off, again, and this idea of, well, yeah, you have to send me twice as many hostages and you have to ship them yourself.
Kind of
bizarre.
Shows how desperate he is to get out of there. But I just thought it was funny that we were talking about how packed the men must have been on their way over because he's lost so many ships. They are packed.
I think they managed to repair some ships with
with
timber or whatever from some of the ships that were destroyed by the bad weather. But still, they've lost some troops, but I don't think they've lost many in these battles.
Yeah, good point.
And you know, the ships that they lost, they probably lost the guys that were on the ships as well. But they're going to be packed in even tighter than sardines.
Yeah.
So he heads back. Of course, the British don't send their hostages.
I don't want to ruin it, but only two tribes out of everybody, and we're talking smaller tribes, send anybody the following spring or whatever.
Yeah, which of course, you know, we'll see what happens as a result of that. But
exactly,
Caesar gets back to Gaul, and the fact that this was sort of a bit of a disaster of an expedition doesn't really matter.
No,
back in Rome, people are
they're like, "Woo! It's real, and we kicked ass over there." Woo!
Yeah, look. You know, it. See, I said you know again. It. He had been somewhere where no Roman had ever been before. He went to a land that many considered to be mythical.
Right.
Kind of again, like coming back from Atlantis and saying, yeah, Atlantis is real, and I've been there. And
there's some sand. Yeah.
He had some people criticizing him half-heartedly. But I think even Cicero said, actually, I've got some quotes from Tom Holland's book, Rubicon, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Roman Republic, that I have to thank Gareth Jones again for putting us onto. And in fact, Tom Holland is going to be coming on the VIP show.
That's right.
In coming weeks. I've been tweeting with Tom and we're going to line up a date. It really is a well-written book. Won a bunch of awards 10 years ago, 11 years ago when it came out. He says, it was well known that barbarians became more savage the further north one travelled, indulging in any number of unspeakable habits such as cannibalism and even, repellently, the drinking of milk. To teach them respect for the name of the Republic would be an achievement of Homeric proportions. They drink milk. It's disgusting. It's
crazy.
It's now definite that there isn't an ounce of silver in the whole of Britain, Cicero reported a few months later, nor any prospect of loot apart from slaves. And even then, he added, sniffily, it's hardly as though you'd expect a slave with a decent knowledge of music or literature to emerge from Britain, is it?
Ouch.
So there you go, Britain.
Yeah.
You have been bitch-slapped by Cicero.
Now... I'm sorry. Are you finished? I didn't mean to. So you're finished. Okay. So for Caesar, this entire thing, besides the PR and the people in the streets of London of Rome, love this, but it's pretty much been he's got no gold out of it, no pearls, no tin, no nothing. But his troubles are not over. Several of the ships. I can't remember I think it was two ships of 150 men each, if I remember, got blown off course, and they landed a little south of where everybody else landed. So these guys disembark, and they're walking up the coast to get back to Caesar. When the which tribe is that hears about that? It's one of the M tribes. I'm totally losing it here. Do you know which one it is?
No, I don't have this in my notes.
Okay. I'm going to find it in just a second, and then you can edit the hell out of this.
I'll put some hold music on.
There you go. Damn it, where did it go? Okay, so it wasn't the Marini. There we go. Okay,
I'm ready back to them again.
Boom. Yeah. Okay. So the Marini start attacking them, and they thinking that they've just come back from Britain and they've got a bunch of gold or pearls or tin or whatever. And so more and more Marini come. And so they suddenly these 300 men, I believe, are just trapped, and it's not looking good. It's looking like they're all going to be wiped out. And Caesar hears about this, and he takes, and this is what, and I love it when he overcompensates. He takes almost every horseman, every cavalry he has. We're talking thousands, and he rides to save them. And he gets there so quickly, and I'm sure it's such a scary sight that he doesn't lose one single man of those 300. There's some injuries, but they're all alive, and he brings them back. And now we've touched upon Titus Labienus a couple times, and I keep saying I'm going to mention something specific about him, and I haven't, so I'm just going to go ahead and say it now. Caesar is pretty pissed. He's frustrated what happened, and he's mad at the Marini. He's going to teach them a lesson. Now, Titus Labienus likes pain. Not his pain, your pain. He likes to cause pain. He is into that, if you know what I mean. So Caesar keeps him on a very tight leash because he knows Titus Labienus, and he says, off you go. Go get the Marini. So he tracks him down. Now, if you remember a couple of episodes ago, the Marini went and hid in the marsh. But this year it's been very dry. It's been very hot, and a lot of the marshes have been, you know, reduced. And so there's a lot more land where they go. And so Titus is able to come upon them pretty quickly. And he's about to do what he does very well. He's about to have a pain party. And then a note comes from Caesar saying, okay, no, just, you know, subdue them. So they surrender. So Titus doesn't get to indulge his whims, but he's able to subdue them. The other tribe, Menapi, were already subdued before Caesar left. So at least along the edges of the coast, he's got everything back under control. But again, he knows the second he leaves that people are going to try something, because like he said himself, these people love freedom and they hate slavery, and he's just going to keep having to keep them contained, and that's going to be his job for the foreseeable future.
All right, Labienus plays a big role later on in the Civil War too. We'll have a lot more to say about him then, I'm sure. So the whole first campaign of Britain didn't really work out as Caesar had planned. Not that he had planned much, apart from let's just go check it out.
check it out.
But didn't matter. In terms of propaganda, it was huge. He was voted 20 days of public Thanksgiving, five more than the 15 that he got after he defeated the Gauls and the Germans.
Was already more than what Pompey had gotten. So, wow, you know, yeah. Pompey's got to be pissed.
So that puts it in perspective. He's been in Gaul. He's done all of these things that have had genuine value, have brought wealth into Rome, have subdued attacking tribes. And he got 15 days of that, but to go to Britain and achieve nothing and lose men and ships, he got 20 days. It must have just blown their minds. I mean, I'm sure he put a positive spin on it, no doubt, but just going to this new land, Rome conquers. I mean, you got to remember, too, I think that a century before this, Rome's official dominions was actually quite small.
Right.
You know, Rome had been around for at this stage nearly, you know, 700 years, I guess. For most of that time, their empire was very small. They didn't start spreading out until sort of the early second century BCE. Any capture of new lands, any expansion of the Roman Empire, the name of Rome, any new discoveries, it's a big deal. Columbus coming back from the New World, or it's Captain Cook coming back from Australia, or, you know, he was an explorer. He's gone to a distant galaxy and returned, you know. People are astounded. It's huge, absolutely huge. Caesar decides he's going to go back to Britain.
He's got to after all that, and he said in the winter, what am I going to do next year? Oh, yeah, Britain part two.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's going back.
That's where we're going to leave the history part of the show today, I think. Is that enough?
Yeah. I'm happy.
Okay, folks, look, it's Cameron just cutting in here for a second. That's the end of the history part of the show. If you want us, if you're not interested in the rest of the stuff, which is basically us reading the reviews over the from the last couple of weeks, having a laugh and thanking our patrons, then just turn it off now and go listen to something else. The next section is about 20 minutes of us thanking people and reading reviews. So fair warning, if you're not interested in that, go away and don't complain that we spend all of our time talking about stuff. But to us, our listeners, the people who write reviews, the patrons, the VIPs, the consoles, they're all an important part of the journey, an important part of why we do this. It's all about the community. So we're going to do it. And if you don't like it, tough titties. All right. You have been warned. Right. Okay. So before we wrap up, though, Ray, we need to do some things.
We do. We really, really do.
Most importantly, I want to thank all of our patrons that have joined us since the last time we mentioned them, but in the last month. And I'm going to read all of them because I can't remember where we left. So these are the names of the patrons, the yes. people that are financially supporting the show by sending us some bucks. They're on our Thank wall you. Of patrons, if you're not up there. We appreciate that. You know, this...
Absolutely.
Yeah. For a whole bunch of reasons, we're trying to do more of this. We need to make an income out of it. We're looking at different ways of doing that. But your donations all help.
Good Particularly start. That's right.
Cover the costs of servers and bandwidth. I've gone through all sorts of troubles in the last month. Wow. Having to move servers and buy more bandwidth and all that kind of stuff. So, Jay, and I'm probably going to mispronounce these names as badly as I mispronounce my Latin. But anyway, apologies if I mispronounce your name. James Lasecki, Darren Bostock, Tony Kyneston, Michael Snyder, Jamie Brindle, Christopher Barber, David Ryland, James Taylor, Matthew Pierce, Stephen Carfora, Peter Laurent, Christian Thomas, Bradley Wykes, John Kaichek, Christopher Scrace. Mm-hmm. He's got a brother in here too. I'm going to get them both wrong. I'll say Scrace. Sally Sharp, Karen Dodd, some ladies. Good to see the ladies in there.
Ladies.
Alan Paul Walker, Hannah Stoll, Kelly Le Hondieu, Justin McHenry, Joseph Strotman, Paul Kinderman, Kerwin Schroeder, Vergara Colapaccia Pedinti. bit of the Indian and a bit of the Italian in there, Pedinti. Lorna Crosby, Owen Pitts, Per Oversleen, Richard Giles, Wallace Schubach, Ryan McManus, Thomas Scrace, Catherine Batchelder, Ernest Concepcion, Alan Weber, Svein Sørstad, he's our Norwegian rock god, Liam yes. and Nancy Bussell, David Kelly, Ben Relian told me, he asked me to put his wife's name, Nancy, in there. He said it was an anniversary present to his wife.
Oh, that's nice.
I said, geez, dude, like you've gone over the top here.
You know? You don't ever have to get her anything again.
I know. Her name's on the wall. David Kelly, Ben Russett, Christopher Kenny, and Gary Hughes. They are our Woo! Patrons.
Thank
you very much, guys. That's awesome. Now, I also, we got to do some iTunes reviews. We can't really read them all out in detail. There's 34 of them, I think, since the last time we mentioned them. But I'm going to read some highlights, Ray, if that's okay.
Absolutely it is.
Ray. First of all, I am, you know, and he knows I'm going to do this. Chris MVB from the United States says, this will yet be another review that dwells on Cameron's tendency to be obnoxious. If the duo wanted the reviews to be more on the topic material, it would behoove them to stop making such a big deal out of the hate Cameron gets. So why do people hate Cameron so much? Well, the answer is actually pretty intuitive, and Cameron's befuddlement over why it happens cannot possibly be genuine. It's First cute. Of all, there is the meta angle of the delight he takes in pissing people off. Second, his sarcasm in response to those that wish he would tone it down. However, neither of those really approach is the heart of the matter. He is a non-American who spends his podcast that is ostensibly about Rome to criticize America. Why is this particularly obnoxious? I think he means obnoxious. Well, it's very simple. Imagine you have a mother who is a terrible cook. What would be more offensive to you? Your sister saying that your mother is a terrible cook, or your neighbor saying your mother is a terrible cook? Perhaps this analogy will illuminate matters for Cameron. So I'm going to mention this because I get this sometimes. Americans saying, I shouldn't criticize America because I'm not American. And my response is this: when America butts the hell out of the rest of the world's affairs, then I will stop criticizing America. While America feels that it's their God-given duty to intervene and interfere in the rest of the world's affairs, then they're fair game. Secondly, America is the Rome of the late 20th and early 21st century, and everything that, when America sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. So if you don't want to be talked about, you know, shut the fuck up and stop interfering in world's affairs. That's my response to that. And I'm so sorry it offends your delicate sensibilities, Chris MVB, but, you know, grow the fuck up.
And also, it's Zeus given rights, not God given rights.
Thank That's you. All I
was. Yeah, yeah.
Actually, my actual response was going to be to quote Cicero. I should have done that, but I can tell him to shut the fuck up. But Cicero would have said, "But to conquer one's own temper, to check one's anger, to show moderation towards the conquered, to take a fallen enemy, preeminent in birth, character, and virtue, and not merely raise him up, but actually enhance his former standing, that is the act of someone whom I would not rank with the greatest of men, but would judge akin to a god."
Oh, I like that.
I've been reading Pro Marcello, his speech where he thanked Caesar when he was a dictator, which, if you haven't read, just read it, man. It is an absolute masterpiece of cynical flattery.
Gotcha.
Okay, going to quickly run through the rest of the reviews. Philip G. White calls me drunk uncle and you gullible nephew, which I like. Tom of HB from the United States, thank you. BJ Holmes from the United States. Giant Lizard King from the United States, thank you. Phillips Lego from the United States. Brendan Ottoman from the United States. Hard to read some of these usernames when they're all linked together.
Right.
He says it's fantastic fun. Introduces listeners to a variety of events. Phil McKnight recently started walking to work, so I thought instead of listening to music, I'd listen to podcasts. Came across Life of Caesar. Thoroughly impressed. Thank you, Philip. Ray, a.k.a. Coulter from the United Kingdom. Hey, guys, you've made walking the dog a real pleasure. People now think I'm mad when walking and laughing out loud at your banter. I should have read it.
Hello, you've made walking the dog a real pleasure. People now think I'm mad when walking and laughing out loud at your banter.
Yeah.
Yes.
The dog is mad.
Your twisted sense of humour, you could both pass for English people. Except our noses aren't quite up our butt sides.
Hey, have the Scottish voted to leave the United Kingdom yet? I don't know where that's at.
I don't think it's going to happen. But
I hope it happens. As with Scottish relatives, I hope they give them the finger. Anyway. Now, here, Blubtofly 2008 from the United States says, seriously, what's the problem? Cameron takes a lot of flack for being sarcastic and snarky, but I find it to be amusing.
Yeah.
Thank you. The great dictator from Australia says, from a young age, I've dreamt of becoming the supreme ruler of my own nation. With this podcast, you too can learn how to become a dictator through this step-by-step manual. Step one, borrow huge amounts of money. Step two, use this money to become popular and well-known. Step three, commit genocide and make it into a best-selling book. Step four, pull a Sulla.
That's pretty much all you have to do. Boom, right there.
We are teaching the peoples. He also says, both hosts are great. People are very unfair to Cameron. He plays a vital role in keeping the energy and passion alive in the show, as well as having his own cache of Caesarian knowledge. Ray does more of the storytelling, and he tells it well. Unlike some Americans, his accent is quite pleasant to listen to. So there you go.
Thank you.
You got something there.
Well, I have to hide my Southern accent. I actually do have a Southern accent, but I tone it down.
You do turn it down. You shouldn't, man. The ladies be loving the Southern accent.
Hello, I'm Ray from Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, I'm getting turned on by that.
Hold on to me, too, because I can tell. Anyway.
You sound like Kevin Spacey on House of Cards.
That's right. He's my hero.
Isn't he great? Yeah. Lord Mays from the United States says it's a great podcast. Keep up the awesome work. Thank you, Lord Mays. Satisfied Addict from the United States says Ray Cassidy and the Sundance Cam. Being an American and a Christian almost automatically determines that I will dislike this podcast, but that is just not so. The first grueling hour of listening to Ray and Cam together was indeed difficult, but after I crossed the threshold of not caring about Ray's methodical laughter at Cam's bashes to his personality, I began to enjoy the show much more. I don't think that's fair. I don't bash your personality.
I am too way secure in myself to care. So that's why I laugh. I love me.
You're so secure, you can do the podcast nude smoking a cigar. Well, that's got to be a picture. I got to get Per or Ernest to
draw
up. There's a plethora of factoids and a wealth of knowledge that constantly seep from the minds of these two fantastic hosts. With Cameron, from his incessant Monty Python references to his spot-on Godfather impressions, there's always an element of surprise when it comes to his ability to draw unusual parallels to Napoleon and modern Western civilization from the life of this titan of whom they teach. Thank you. And he also calls you His Excellency, His Imperial Majesty, Emperor Raymond Harris of Virginia.
Oh,
by the way, I just read in the news this morning that the former governor of Virginia's just guilty been done on corrupted charges.
Guilty on all 11, and his wife is guilty on 8. Just that they had a really good time in the governor's house, and they had a marriage falling apart, and they decided to deal with that stress by embezzlement and other things.
Nice. Virginia, love it. Beetlebrox from the United States says he would rate it more, but the Aussie just brings the show down. He comes across as openly hostile towards people of religion, especially Christians, for no reason and out of the blue. I got through 4 episodes and then just had to quit listening. Good riddance to you, Beetlebrox. You take the stick out of your backside. I like this one from Peter Laurent in Ireland. The greatest history podcaster is back, and he has a new sidekick whose name is Ray.
Oh, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter Laurent. Ian Katt, the guy I went to see the Cave film with, who's also a marvelous podcaster in his own right, writes a very nice review. He says, as for the host, well, with imaginations like these two, they could be writing Seinfeld episodes. But as podcasters, they'll probably just fade into obscurity. Isn't that true?
Yes.
Thank you, Ian. Betrosius from the United States. I like this show so much, it's actually a problem. Pietro Giampa, incredibly well done podcast. Thank you. He's from Canada. Thank you, Pietro. He says, hashtag Paula Sula. Very good. Triants from the United States. Painful to listen to. Not funny. Not interesting. So there you go, Triants. absolutely terrible is his review. Dave from the United States, who's also got some weird Cyrillic username, says, I'm through 7 episodes, definitely enjoying it. Sure, you've got to take some of it cum grano salis, so to speak. I think that means with a grain of salt, right?
Yeah, there we go. I'm impressed.
There you go. Very good. Thank you, Dave.
Yes,
Oil Can, the great from the United States. Ray has an incredible depth of knowledge concerning the smallest details in Julius Caesar's life. On the other hand, Cam works real hard to get the podcast an explicit rating. For the record, I think it was Ray who started dropping the Samuel L. Jackson F-bombs first on the show.
I am so
he set the standard. But I'll take the heat. I can handle it. Chris Minyard from the United States says, it's amazing. Truly love this podcast. Recommend it to everyone. 804 Spider-Man from the United States. I never thought that listening to two peoples talking about history could be so funny. Keep up the good work and the mispronunciations. Cameron, he writes in brackets.
We will.
Thank you, Spider-Man. Natty, 345, great podcast. Thank you, Natty. Mozzie from Aussie. I'm really enjoying this podcast based loosely on the life of Julius Caesar. When I say loosely, I don't mean that in a negative way, as Ray and Cameron also bring in a lot of other topics, eventually relating back to Caesar and the fall of the Republic, and some really not.
We're looking at the big picture.
Lots of Facts and Laughs by N. Schulte 25. This is a fun and informative podcast. Cato/Pulasula, brilliant podcast. Not only has he given me all the info I need of Caesar, but he's given me a new gamer tag, which is Pulasula, I think. No, Sula Pula, he's got as his gamer tag. Very cool, man.
Yeah.
Mine is Rahalik, by the way, if you want to hit me up on Xbox Live. WLDB1988 from Canada says, I've never binged listened to a podcast before last weekend. I got through every episode and loved it.
Wow.
Thank you, WLD. Yes. Sacto Fat Man from the United States. I'm a big fan and will go this far and claim that Ray and Cameron are the Cheech and Chong of history podcasting.
Yes.
We'll take that. Pulling a Sula and demanding my wife cook my breakfast. Hope that went well for you, Sacto Fat Man from the United States. Scarelaugh from Australia. This being my first podcast, I find it an amazing one to listen to. Both hosts are witty, interesting, and funny. Your first podcast. We've had a couple. We got an email from Who was the guy in the truck?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, God. I didn't even put a picture of the truck on it. That was cool.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man, I feel bad now that I can't.
Because we were his first.
First ever podcast.
Ever, yes.
Tim? Yes, Tim Henning. I got to read this out. I posted on Facebook. I've got to read it. He's from California. Gentlemen, I purchased a new iPod Nano about 2 weeks ago. I downloaded your Life of Caesar podcast, and I am so happy I did. This is the first podcast I've ever listened to, and wow. I'm so impressed that I can't wait to listen to the next episode. I'm on episode 11 and listen to at least three per day.
Oh, my God.
He's not the truckie, though. There was another guy who's a truck driver who listens to it. I'm sorry, truckie, dude.
Was truck it, dude.
Was it Gary, someone? Anyway.
Yeah.
I'm looking for, we got so many emails. Listen, seriously, yeah. we get hundreds of emails. It's great. We appreciate it, folks. Yeah, great.
Absolutely.
We
absolutely.
Love the emails. Arve@lifeofcaesar.com. Tell us a bit about yourself, where yes. you live, what you do. We love hearing about who you are. The emails we get make my day, quite honestly.
And we do reply to them. So, yeah, you'll hear back from us.
I reply.
I've been doing better. I really, really have. But I don't always CC you on it because I figure you don't want to read it. But I have been doing better.
I want to know that you're holding up your end of the deal, man.
Then I will CC you.
Finally, let me finish the reviews. Brewster Rooster 21, really enjoying this, fellas. Quite absorbed in the fact that your show is quirky and not a dissertation. Thank you, Brewster Rooster. Yeah. Scipio Handel from the United States. I've been listening to this podcast while working at a piano restoration warehouse.
Oh, wow.
I love listening to these two guys. Thank you, sir. Aradolfo from the United States. I listen to a number of BBC history podcasts, and these two are a welcome change. Very good. Amidst the funny banter, the pod is information dense. Thank you, Aradolfo. And lastly, Scootin' Skaug Skorg from the United States. My wife openly admits that she is a history snob. She loves learning about the history and the culture of Rome. For me, I liked history and thought it was neat. But when I started to listen to this podcast, I became amazed at all the things I never knew. Now being armed and equipped with my newfound knowledge, mm-hmm. I feel I can pull a Sulla and dominate Roman topic conversations. I now have a new love and appreciation for history and the Roman Empire. I plan to impress my wife with what I have gained from two witty, or at least one is, men who have intelligent, or at least humorous, discussions on life in Rome. Thank you. I will now impress my wife with my Roman history knowledge. Which one of us is the witty one?
I was going to say, right? don't let that hurt your feelings. But anyway, and that's what this entire podcast is all about. You learn something, you have a laugh. And that's really what we want to do. I mean, you giving us your time to listen to this is like the most important thing you could possibly do. So if you're learning... And for money, tons of money, and cocaine. If you're learning and you're laughing, that's all we care about, and money.
That's right. Okay, so glad you put the money bit in, Ray. Just to finish up, guys, if you want to become a patron, go up to lifeofcaesar.com/patron. If you want to register for our console shows where we interview the VIP guests, lifeofcaesar.com/console. Don't forget to go to the shop, buy a t-shirt, buy a mm-hmm. sticker, buy a tote bag. That's lifeofcaesar.com/shop to get the links to that, or the playing cards that we have up now.
Yep.
The Pula Sula shirt that we've got up on the shop that Ernesto Concepcion, mm-hmm. world famous artist, did for us. Check that out. It's gruesome. It's awesome.
I bought one. I'm going to wear it to the beach. I can't wait.
Yeah, I bought one too. I buy all of our shirts, man. I love them.
I love that other shirt. You got the black one with the
insignia that, yes, that Per Oversleen
awesome.
Did. I know,
that
man.
Is awesome.
I wore that to a meeting with a client the other day. I love that. I also get all the stickers and I stick them on my laptop, which I love. What else? Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/lifeofcaesar. Yes. We're on Twitter @lifeofcaesar. And the patrons, if you're not on our Facebook and you haven't seen this, we are starting live shows tomorrow. We are doing our first ever live show where our mm-hmm. patrons are invited to jump on Skype with Ray and I and have a live chat about Caesar, Napoleon, World War II, anything from any of our history podcasts or just anything, our sex lives, what Ray looks like naked smoking a cigar, how to kill a snake.
That's right.
Sex tips. That's right. The whole deal.
Okay. I'll tune in.
Hopefully, you know. Oh no, I was going to say. yeah. I got chewed out in the History Facebook, History Podcasters Facebook group this week, Ray. We probably saw by one of our listeners or ex-listeners, I don't know now, Louis Duvall, who was, you know, quite upset by the fact that I said Fidel Castro wasn't batshit crazy. In doing so, proved that Louis is, in fact, batshit crazy with this massive rant that he did. My God. I mean, but look, we get a few crazies who listen to the show, but all in all, you guys are great, so thank you.
Right.
All right.
I think that's it.
All right. I'm gonna go out with Jesse's girl.
All right.
Do you want to have another crack at singing it, or I just splice in the one from before?
Yeah, you just do some splicing because I'm changing the words.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. That's it.
That's it.